everyone was all for inclusion. There wasn't anybody who felt that this movement toward inclusion was anything but good. It was, they thought this was excellent. But what there was a lot of worry about is that in our focus on inclusion, that we've turned away from thinking about teaching of analysis per se, of what goes on with the analyst and the patient, teaching how we work with people, how we think about people, how countertransference gets lost in this way, even though there's a focus on the countertransference in terms of discrimination. But that's just one factor. So there was a lot of concern that we could lose the interest in development, the interest in intrapsychic life.
Welcome to the Psychoanalysis On and Off the Couch podcast. For the past few years, we've been speaking with analysts from around the world who've been applying their analytic way of thinking not only to their offices, but also off the couch in venues external to their consulting rooms. We've spoken to analysts who work in hospitals, in prisons, in community health centers, in refugee clinics, just to name a few. We've also detoured, of course, during COVID. We've spoken with analysts again from around the world to learn from our communities how they, their patients, and the analytic community in general have been dealing with this crisis. And hopefully, the worst is over, and we can return to our main focus. We can return to speaking to analysts who are bringing their skills to people who otherwise would never see the inside of an analyst's office. In addition to that, we're speaking with the elders of our field, people who have been practicing this craft for 40 and 50, sometimes longer years, to learn from them what they have to teach us, not only about this piece of history that we're all living through, but their reflections on our field. Please visit us at our website, ipaoffthecouch.org, where you can leave a comment, where you can subscribe. I hope you find these conversations thoughtful and meaningful, and I appreciate your listening. Thank you. Welcome to today's podcast. I'm Harvey Schwartz, and my guest today is Dr. Judy Kantrowitz. This is Dr. Kantrowitz's second visit to the podcast. The first was a bit over a year ago, episode 83, when she and I discussed her work interviewing former analyst sans about the nature of their termination experiences. At that time, she discovered that talking to people about their experiences reveals a different type of information than one gets from just reading the literature or listening to instructors teach courses on termination. And it became part of her book, Myths on Termination. And she's continued this approach of interviewing people to learn about their truths in this current project that we discussed today, and that is she interviewed analysts who were above the age 70 about what it's like for them to be above the age 70, and in particular, what it's like to be psychoanalysts above the age 70, how their work has changed over the years, how they've managed the travails of aging, the pleasures of life, the regrets of life, how they view our field. It is, as one has come to expect from Judy Kantrowitz, a rich, deeply personal, and very enlivening conversation about the work at hand. Dr. Kantrowitz is a training and supervising analyst at the Boston Psychoanalytic Institute, and she's formerly a clinical associate professor at Harvard Medical School. She is the author of four books, The Patient's Impact on the Analyst, Writing About Patients, Responsibilities, Risks, and Ramifications, Myths of Termination, What Patients Can Teach Analysts About Endings, and the role of patient-analyst match in the process and outcome of psychoanalysis. She has served three times on the editorial board of the Journal of the American Psychoanalytic, and she also won their prize in 2020. She is currently on the board of the Psychoanalytic Quarterly, and she is in private practice of psychoanalysis and psychoanalytic psychotherapy in Brookline, Massachusetts. As always, when one engages Judy about her work in psychoanalysis, not only does one learn a lot, because of course that's the case, but there is a sort of a magnetic delight that at least I experience when hearing her talk about something that she feels so deeply about. And I hope you have that same satisfaction as I do. Here's my conversation with Dr. Judy Kantrowitz. Judy, welcome to the podcast. It's so good to have you back again. Judy, you and I first spoke a bit over a year ago, and at that time we discussed the interviews you had conducted with analysts who reported to you what their own experiences in their own terminations were. And you learned a great deal. In fact, it became the basis of your book, Myths of Termination. And what you learned demonstrated that the truth of various matters, in that case termination, isn't exactly what's written about and isn't exactly what's taught in termination courses. And you learned from that, though I suspect you knew it as already, that the best way to learn about people's experiences is to speak with them. And so you've come back with another survey. This time, it's a survey of analysts over the age of 70 about what their professional careers have been like, what their regrets are, what their pleasures are, their hopes, their vision of the future, how they've dealt with health matters and all the exigencies of aging. And you've learned a great deal, and I'd like to start us off first by mentioning how common is this group of elders. You've selected people over the age of 70. As reported by the American Psychoanalytic, 66% of its members are over the age of 70. Now, this doesn't account for all the analysts in the States or North America. And this being an IPA podcast, it doesn't reflect the international numbers. The IPA reports that 60% of its members are over the age of 60. So they skew slightly younger, but again, only slightly. Judy, start us off. Tell us about what led you to do this, what you were hoping to learn, and then we'll go through some of the things you did learn.
Sure. First, I want to make a slight correction, which is in the termination book, it isn't only analysts I talk to. I talk to patients who were not themselves analysts. And
okay.
That's an important distinction. And maybe it relates to some of this, because there are lots of things I think we don't know without talking to people and without people having a real opportunity to, you know, to just freely say what their experiences are. So what started me on this project? Well, I think one of the things was Audrey Kafka had contacted me about the work that she was doing about older analysts. You know, she's been the representative for the IPA, and she tells this story that I don't think is apocryphal of her father saying that he wanted to die in his chair. And she said, oh, but what about the patients? And so it started her mission to look at this. Well, you know, I'm one of these older analysts, and to the best of my ability, I think I'm functioning pretty well. I love my work. I wouldn't take on more patients now because I just turned 84. But, you know, that's a statistic. My mother lived to 98. So I wouldn't continue working, but I want to be responsible about it. And so the question was to think about a lot of things about aging. In fact, I started out not thinking about doing this project. I started out thinking about writing something, using literature to illustrate lots of the problems that come with aging. But, you know, I'm an analyst, and it was hard for me to figure out a way to do that, even though a lot of my reading always is in literature. And in some ways, I think there are lots of things in literature that describe this better than we do. But I really wanted to know other people's experiences. What were they thinking? How did they think about this dilemma about what we do as older analysts? And my original thought was to start by interviewing analysts who are over 80. And a friend of mine said, oh, don't do that. That's not wise. Start at 70. Because, you know, really the retirement age is 65. You don't want people saying that this is okay to be practicing over 70, even though for some of us it is. But think of 70 as the beginning of being old. I have to say, there's not much difference in my volunteers of over 70 and over 80, but I took her warning to heart, and I thought, yeah, in a political sense, it probably is important.
Let me just interrupt you to underline what you just said. You didn't see much difference in the thinking between those you interviewed who were in their 70s versus those in their 80s. Is that right?
Right. That's right.
That's a finding in and of itself.
Yeah. But remember, the important thing here, these are volunteers. And volunteers are not representative in a certain way. I mean, what I learned in the Termination Project was that people volunteer for very strong feelings, and that can be positive or negative. And that created a certain bias in my results. And here I would say, you know, the analysts who aren't functioning too well are less likely to volunteer for this. And it was all volunteers. There are three people in this group of 50 who were friends of mine, and I said, are you sure you want to do this? She was asking personal questions. And the answer I got back was, sure. Are you sure you want to ask me? Are you comfortable? And I said, yes. So we went ahead. And there were about 15 people out of my 50 people who I knew professionally, but not well. And the rest I didn't know at all. I had two extras here, actually. I did 52. Because one person was 69, and I thought, since I've set this up, I'm a purist, I won't, you know, do that. And one person was not continuing to take new patients, which many of them were not, but had actually stopped seeing patients in her 70s. Mm-hmm. So, you know, she was very clear her mother had died early, and this was something she was doing. But she said, but I'm working, and I do see patients who come back, and I'm supervise, and you know, and so I interviewed her, and then I thought, no, you know, that isn't really my sample, so that's why I have two extras, but I'm not in what I described. But I really wanted to know how people were thinking about this, because you know, it is a dilemma. It's a dilemma about our satisfactions and pleasures, our ability to think about ourselves squarely. As one person said, gee, I'm functioning well. I have this skill. Why would I retire and do other things? I can still do this. And then there's Audrey's thing of, well, what do we know? And just like this person who volunteered, who said, I stopped with patients when I was, you know, in my 70s. Because my mother died at 45. I could say, well, mine died at 98. But, you know, there's no
guarantee in either direction, right? One of the points you made in what you wrote is the importance of generativity as one ages.
Yes, exactly. And, you know, this is, at least for me, this is a major thing. I not only love doing this with patients, I love doing this with supervisees and candidates. I love mentoring and helping people, you know, along with what they're doing in their career. It's a real pleasure. So, you know, there are many ways of doing it and stopping seeing patients. You can still do this through supervision, consultations, other things, and many people do. And as my own practice, you know, gradually stops, I too will be like that. So anyway, I just really, I guess part of it was a personal question. And one of the things that comes up with this is a few people said they took cognitive tests every so often. But you know, these cognitive tests actually are really not relevant. I mean, I could never count back from 100 by 7, so I'm going to be able to do it now. I mean, that's not really what's relevant to our work. In fact, it made me think, oh, I should design something that would be relevant, like maybe TAT stories and ask people, you know, what they remember once, you know, you go through this. I don't know. But we don't have great ways of doing this. The professional will is a very, very important thing. And we really have to thank Audrey Kafka for doing that, because it means that we have somebody looking over or overseeing for us, not that they're seeing our patients or doing anything like that now, but they're continuing to be there for us. And I know I'm pretty conscientious about this. As I stop seeing someone or as I start seeing someone, I put that on my list. And there are issues about this. And I just presented this paper at APSA. And one of the things someone brought up is, you know, there often are friends who are the people we're most likely to have in this place are not the ones who are most comfortable taking this role. Certainly not the ones who are most comfortable telling us that we're not functioning so well. Although, you know, I think most of us would rather have it from somebody like that. But they feel that the point that was brought up is these analyst assistant committees are very important in that way. And I totally agree. They really are. We really do have to think about this in a very responsible way, because loving your work, you want to keep doing it. And it's easy to kid yourself. So anyway, what this group is high functioning. This is really not a group, but there are many concerns about this. Out of the 50 people, there were only 2 people who I could tell in the interviews had cognitive decline, and both of them are aware of it, and both of them were planning to terminate within the year. The rest of this group were amazing. I mean, they were incredible. There's one in the 90s, 92. And
still seeing patients.
Yes, still seeing patients. I mean, actually, it was one of my first interviews, and it was sort of funny because I said, well, how many hours do you work a week? He said 44. I gasped. He said, no, I don't mean see 44 clinical patients. I see about 8 hours, and then I do other things. I do medication. I do workman's comp. This guy is amazing. He also gardens. He also cooks. It's just extraordinary and totally with it as he described what was going on.
As you described the 50, it was it's such an impressive group, as you noted. They had many interests. They were deeply involved with friends and family and their work. Resilience is one of the qualities you noted in just about all of them. And again, whether that's unique to this group of volunteer analysts or whether that's unique to our field, there is some data that says compared to other medical colleagues, medical analysts live longer than other medical specialties, I think is what the data showed.
Somebody brought this up. It was a survey done about that. Yes, I will say resiliency is one of the most remarkable things, because this is a group that's not without their tragedies and not without, many of them have had serious life-threatening illnesses before. I've forgotten the number exactly, but a lot of them had children who died, some of these by suicide. They've had a lot that's gone wrong. There are 16 of them who were divorced and happily remarried. Another, I don't know, 5 or 6 who were divorced, not remarried, but having good lives. Maybe, you know, people who volunteer for this really are the people who are in really good shape. But it's not just that they've had good fortune. They really, a lot of them have overcome a lot. They're also multi-talented. Huge number of them were serious musicians. Some were artists. Some were writers. Almost all were involved in athletics one way or another, and now currently walk a lot, even if they're not doing other things. They were, they read a lot of books. They went to a lot of movies and theater, not during the pandemic, but you know, before then. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Their interests are wide. But one of the things that really I found most moving, and maybe I'm getting ahead of myself here, Harvey, but what you want to talk about, but when I asked them about their satisfactions, it was people. It was the pleasure they got out of working well with patients. It was their families, their spouses, their children, their grandchildren, their friends, especially when their friends were also colleagues. This is a very related group. People are what matter to them. Not so surprising for people who do this kind of work. Sure, sure. But lovely that that's the satisfaction.
Yeah.
And it was so uniform. There's almost no one in this group who didn't say that.
Hmm.
That was, I mean, that was really interesting and really pleasurable.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about their relationship to psychoanalysis. Because that was one of the things you asked them about, what their professional life was like, how they view the field, how they see moving on into the future. What did you learn there?
Well, I learned some really interesting things that almost all of them, with the exception of three people, said that they are very different from the way they were trained. And the difference is consistently much more related, much more spontaneous. I also asked them about the differences in theory, and they were almost, this group has, you know, and not the so much the ones in the 70s, but all the ones in the 80s and up, have really been trained in ego psychology. They've moved away from that. Not that they don't believe in drive and defense and all of that, but they look at the relationship and they feel a great deal more freedom than was true in our training. Interestingly, only one person said that there was no difference, and it's someone who wasn't trained in an American institute, someone trained outside, who said there was no difference, just as much of an ego psychologist today as earlier, drive, defense, abstinence.
Meaning that they haven't evolved in their approach to clinical work.
Not at all. They're just totally wedded to that. And another person who said, I was always this way. There's no difference from when I, you know, began. I never believed what we were taught like that. And, you know, but wider knowledge of theory, wider influence by theory. But in terms of the actual work, there was no difference. But this was really quite notable for this group, the expansion about the way they thought about how they worked and how much more pleasure they got in the work. And they weren't undisciplined. I mean, no one was describing an anything-goes approach, but just they felt freer about using themselves, about being more spontaneous, about being more connected. Quite notable in this way.
Would you say that people were generally optimistic about the future or pessimistic about the future for the field?
Well, that's a whole other issue. No, there was a lot of pessimism. There was a lot of concern. Everyone was all for inclusion. There wasn't anybody who felt that this movement toward inclusion was anything but good. They thought this was excellent. But what there was a lot of worry about is that in our focus on inclusion, that we've turned away from thinking about the teaching of analysis per se, of what goes on with the analyst and the patient, teaching how we work with people, how we think about people, how countertransference gets lost in this way, even though there's a focus on the countertransference in terms of discrimination, but that's just one factor. So there was a lot of concern that that we could lose the interest in development, the interest in intrapsychic life. The one thing that was people were optimistic about, and only some people cited it, but it did come up a few times, and that was about neuroscience and what we could learn about that. In some ways, though, even when this was brought up, it didn't seem to have so much to do with how we would do our work. It's more that we would understand something differently. So there is generally a concern in the field that we're going to lose our way. The other things that they were concerned about is how expensive analysis has become, how much is involved about insurance, how much has gotten taken over in this way. And concerns that people will take the first patient that comes. In other words, a turn away, not in the sense of turning away from an ego psychology as being a negative thing, but a turn away from thinking systematically about how we work with people. And that came up with almost everybody as real worry about this.
Let me just read two quotes from your paper from two different analysts that you were speaking about. One said, quote, "I'm pessimistic. Our profession is so focused on being inclusive. It's lost its focus. Do anything to get a number of patients. It's lost its developmental focus. It's diluted by doing what is pragmatic. Not everything goes. People take the first patient that comes. They don't wait for ones that can use and benefit from analysis." Another analyst who was more optimistic nevertheless said, "Analysis as a field is narrowing because there are other approaches like neuropsychiatry. Maybe they will be more effective, maybe not. But psychoanalytic theory is changing. I don't know if an interest in intrapsychic conflict will last." That sort of matches what you were summarizing.
Yeah. You picked two quotes that exactly match what I've been describing, and they're representative quotes. These things came up a lot. It's a worry. I mean, at my own institute, I think we're still getting a lot of good patients. We have a lot of good supervisors.
You're at the Boston Psychoanalytic.
Yeah, and we're one of the bigger institutes. And I think many people worry about this, but the curriculum has broadened, and that may be all to the good. But there is, there is this concern.
Concerned that the inner life of the patient will be obscured by the focus on externals? Is that what you mean?
Uh-huh. Exactly. And, as I say, I think we haven't felt the bad effects locally so much about this. But, it's there. And certainly I know that the concern about programs at the American have been focused in that direction so much that many people don't want to go.
Yeah, I've heard that as well, yeah. The subject, that's called lifers. It's a term that is now increasingly being spoken about, and I have reservations about the term because I think it's sort of like the term borderline. It could mean something, but it's really just used pejoratively. My understanding of who lifers are is it's those individuals who've maintained ongoing contact with their analyst. And it's something that came up in your data, something that people had feelings about. And it seems that it would be useful to approach it by not using a descriptive label, but by trying to use a dynamic understanding of it. And to me, there are people who maintain ongoing contact with their analyst because it's what enables them to live the best life they can live. There are others who maintain ongoing contact because the analyst doesn't know how to facilitate a termination. There are others where the analyst may be garnering their own satisfactions, either emotional or financial. And there are also categories of people who maintain ongoing contact who began their treatment as analysands, and presumably thereby with the assumption that there would be a termination, and that there are others who maintain contact who began in a supportive therapy, and the assumption wasn't necessarily built in at the beginning that they would terminate. So it's actually a complex subject, but your interviewees had thoughts about it. Can you share some?
Sure. And I mean, it's one of the questions I've had myself. I mean, this both Audrey's concern when her father said, you know, I want to die in my chair. You know, what do we do for these patients who are still there, you know, if we continue and if we don't set a termination date this way? A lot of the things you said, Harvey, are what come up in the interviews. There are people who say, you know, if obviously, if you're doing it for yourself, if it's an ongoing revenue for you, that's really not okay. But I don't think in general that's the situation for analysts. I mean, maybe for some, but I don't think that was true for anyone I talked to. The question is, as some people put it, well, is this patient continuing and using me rather than finding someone in his or her life? That's one question. Another question is just the way you put it, which I think is very important. Is being in treatment allowing this person to be their best self? You know, the issue of termination, once you take self-psychology seriously, you have to say, well, you know, there's some people who really need this. And when they really need this, then, as somebody in the study put it, it's like medicine. And why should that be taken away? One of the most encouraging things I found about thinking about that question, because it's a troubling question, you know, what are we doing when we do this, is that people who are like this, you know, when any of us die or stop, we'll find somebody else. Sometimes we help them, or sometimes those people who have our professional wills will be the one to help them. But if that's what they really need, they're going to find someone else. Mm-hmm. One of the people in the study described coming to a point in her life where she really felt she needed an older, wiser, really experienced analyst. And she appealed to one of these people who was like that, who was very reluctant to take her on. But he finally did. And she said it was a life-changing experience for her. And
do you know how old the older analyst was?
Oh, in his early 90s. I mean, you know.
Oh, is that right?
Young. But someone who was very well respected, very wise. And she said, you know, she got something that she just felt, you know, that maybe there's someone else who could have given her, but she'd had analyses before, and this was very different. And, you know, so this, I found this encouraging. Oh, another thing that somebody said that I hadn't thought of this way, except, well, maybe I did, so I'll tell you how, is that sometimes patients really want to stay with you as a representation of their parents, of wanting to be able to do something for you that maybe they couldn't or didn't do with their parents. I remember years ago, we had an analyst who was taking care of her elderly analyst, and people were very critical of this. Mm-hmm. And she and I were talking at one point, and she said to me, I know people are critical of this, but you know, the reality is, this is my pleasure. And I'm ready for her to die when she does, but to be there for her, to be with her, to help her through this time, she did it for me. And it's my pleasure to do it for her. So, you know, what can I say? It's people are different with this, but I would say personally, it made me feel more relaxed about this because it's one of the things I have a concern about. I think your distinction is a very good one, Harvey. The patients who have been analysands, who then become once a weekers or something like that, every other weekers. I've got a number like that. And I don't see their ending. I really don't. I see they use me in a way that is very useful to them. They each have particular issues and problems in their life that, you know, I understand better than probably anyone else would. Do I think they couldn't function without me? No. Do I think they'll go to someone else when I stop working or I die? Maybe, but maybe not. But that's different, and I think your distinction is a very good one. With patients who are therapy patients who come and just stay. I'm trying to think about that. I actually personally don't have patients like that. My therapy patients are patients who work analytically, even though it's therapy.
Mm-hmm.
And they're really working. So it's a very, I don't think of them that way. Where I do with these former analytic patients, I do. But some patients come needing kind of supportive work, and they may need that forever. And I think one of the things I ended up feeling listening to everyone was, yeah, they'll find somebody else. So, I mean, I think this is something I really learned in this study. I don't know that it was really a conscious question for me personally when I started, but as I listened, I realized, yeah, this is something I wanted to know more about how people thought about it, even though I asked the question, but
right.
I hadn't realized how much of a question it was for me. I actually found it very reassuring. I mean, obviously, we would like, particularly with our analytic patients, with all patients, I think, to feel that you could carry work through until the ending. And obviously, based on my other work, I'm particularly interested in termination. And the idea of being able to mourn, being able to go on in a more independent way after that. But that's not for everybody. And
yeah.
It's, you know, our work needs to be matched to the given person. If it's a resistance and you're really not doing something, somebody said, you could have someone else in your life, or if you're in an impasse, that's a different thing. But, you know, people are different and they use this work differently, and that's okay.
You know, Judy, you are, of course, in the age group that this study is focused on. And so it sounds like that you would answer the question how you have changed by saying, if I hear you right, that you're more accepting of your situation with certain patients who are maintaining contact with you when you perhaps didn't anticipate it or had questions about whether there was some limitation in you or the work that led to it. You're saying you're taking a deeper breath and being more accepting of it. Is that a fair characterization?
I think that's very fair. You know, the thing, I'm not exactly like the person in the study who says, you know, I'm no different than I was to begin with. But I never accepted the strict ego-psychological approach we were taught. It just seemed to me inhuman and basically not helpful. Too many people suffer from self-criticism, from isolation, from, you know, my first control patient probably is not someone who should have been in analysis, but certainly not a classical analysis.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I did what I had to do, but I felt terrible. And she came back to see me years later when her mother had died. And she said to me afterwards, oh my God, why couldn't you have been like this with me when I was in analysis? And believe me, I was never like these really abstemious analysts. But, you know, I knew it wasn't. I just felt for me it wasn't right. And I
you were also more seasoned as a person and as a clinician.
Yeah. I mean, I think we use ourselves. And it shouldn't be in an undisciplined way. And I certainly believe that self-disclosure can be an interference, but sometimes it's appropriate and sometimes it's useful. That doesn't mean turning it so that you're doing a mutual analysis, but, you know, to be human and responsive seems to me important. But the work is about our patients, not about ourselves.
Right.
Is that what we do? I don't, in a way, I don't mean that, because we learn about ourselves so much in every treatment if we're open to it. So, you know, our countertransferences and what we learn help us grow and be better about doing the work. But that's on our own time. What we do with our patients, I think, is to focus on them and then to use the benefits of what we figure out ourselves about what's getting in our way.
That was something I noted in your reports from some, not all of the analysts, that they answered the question about how they changed in relation to theory. And that seemed to me to be missing the essential point. The way I would frame the question would be, what have you learned from your years of working with patients that has impacted your approach and technique? Which is what you've just begun to respond to. I was going to turn the tables on you and ask you the questions that you ask them, and I just did. What is it that you've learned from your years of working with patients?
I think it's not so much a change in theory, because I think my theory always was broader, and I was always, I mean, I'll never forget when I read Lowell, I thought, ah, yes, that's what I think.
That's what I think, yeah, right. A lot of people have that experience, yeah.
I think we're with 1968, yeah. And there weren't many papers like that, but I thought, okay, there is somebody who thinks the way I think. And that didn't really change that much over time. It broadened. I learned a lot more. But what I would say is what I learned is I learned how I got in the way of the work. I learned what it was in me. In each case, it sort of comes out of the countertransference. And when I get stuck or blocked in some way, I learned something about myself that freed me further to do the work, like an ongoing part of analysis. I had, in the days when I was trained, I had a relatively short analysis. I had actually, not surprising, given my interest in termination, what I thought was a terrible termination because it was very short and abrupt, and my analyst absolutely didn't understand what that meant to me. And I was very clear that it did actually give me a lot of insight about how abrupt my separation must have been, because it was so horrible. But I learned a lot, and I continue each patient in a certain way would present something that I feel like I don't get a little stalled in the work in some way. And then I dream and I analyze my dreams. And one of the things I always did, and I continue to do, is peer supervision. So since I feel pretty comfortable about being open about myself, it's not hard to bring in the things that get in my way, to talk about them. And, it's extremely helpful. Nowadays, it's not so much new, but still, sometimes, and I sort of feel the same way about writing. But when I write, I find that I'm discovering something. I often don't know, and the writing leads me to a place. But the clinical work clearly leads me to a place of learning more, because each person can bring in something that I don't understand enough in myself. And when I find I'm blocking in that way, I'll give you an example. It's a very old example. I wrote a paper about it a long time ago, but it's a pretty good one. It was after my analysis, and I started dreaming about a patient I was seeing, just the patient's face, nothing else. And it would happen night after night. And I thought, this is the weirdest thing. And it wasn't a patient I had any strong countertransference feelings for. And finally, I said to myself, okay, so if I were to go back and talk to my analyst, which maybe I should, what would I be saying? And I began to tell the story of my patient, who, when he was 4 years old, was left to babysit for his brother. And his 2-year-old brother. His brother fell out the window. His mother
fell out the what? I didn't hear.
Window.
Window. Oh.
His mother accused him of pushing his brother out the window. He's 4 years old. I mean, what he's doing, babysitting for this,
yeah,
something else again. But he was quite sure he hadn't done that. But he was just as guilty and filled with pain as if he had. And this is what I thought I would tell my analyst. And then I had an image of standing in front of a summer house when I was 4 years old, and this ambulance coming and taking my mother to the hospital. She had a miscarriage, and I'm an only child. And in that moment, I understood something that I'd never understood before, that much as if I spent my life saying how much I want another sibling, that I didn't want that sibling, and that I felt guilty and wanted that sibling gone in that way, which was the reverse of anything conscious I'd ever thought before. And clearly must have been right, because I never dreamt about the patient again.
Hmm.
But in other words, I was having a guilt that was resonating with his guilt, neither of us being responsible for what happened, but feeling guilty nonetheless about the wish of not having this younger sibling. But it was so striking and informative to me. It took my breath away. It was very early in my training. But
what is also striking and informative about that vignette is that you gained access to the insight through picturing yourself being back in analysis, speaking with your analyst. And this was a point that you and I discussed in our first conversation around your work on termination, trying to distinguish whether one interjects the analytic process or whether one interjects the analyst, as if those are very distinct. And your work then demonstrated that it's not so distinct. That many of us maintain ongoing connections with our experience of our analyst, which is the medium of our processing, which you just demonstrated so beautifully.
Yeah. I would say over time, that's probably less true for me. But yeah, absolutely. But it is in connection with another person. I mean, I've written about many examples of this, but you know, my son, who was 31, died of a brain tumor in early 2000. And I moved him very deeply and very painfully, quite openly. But what I discovered is that there was an ongoing process that I was totally unaware of. But again, I need another person. I'm not sure it's the analyst in this way. A friend of mine said to me, I had written this book about writing about patients, and I'd interviewed analysts about how they use disguise or consent or what happened for sort of around the world with this. Again, interviewing with a lot of fun. But she said to me, this is so different from what you usually write about. What led you to do this? And I said, without any forethought, I was being a reporter. And then I thought, oh, my son was a reporter. So I was sort of inhabiting his position without consciously knowing that. When I wrote about this and presented a paper in which I described that, my discussant said, and maybe your termination book is also related to this. And I have to say, I again had the same thought. There was no conscious notion on my part in either of these things that that's what I was doing. But really, I was doing something about a mourning process through the writing, through the work, and I needed another person to help me see what I was doing. So, you know, I'm not sure it has to be
around. Yeah.
It could be. But at
it
least
sets the template for being open to other connections like that.
For me, the thought of discovery is almost always in reality or in representation in my mind in connection with somebody else. I'm telling somebody else. I'm thinking about someone else in that way. Not alone in that. So, you know, I mean, we're different. Not everybody's like this, but for sure. And, you know, in this continuation about how we keep analysis alive, there's some very interesting work. We've valorized this notion of self-analysis, and maybe a very independent American tradition in this way. But Yeller and Friedman have done some interesting work that distinguishes between talking to yourself and talking to another. And I think that's what you're raising, Harvey. This is, we generally talk to another. We don't just talk to ourselves. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I suspect some people do. But it's such a, once you're in this and if analysis opens up enough for you, it's such an ongoing process. And that's why it's so hard, I think, for people to retire, because the connection of offering something that we found ourselves that's so useful to somebody else, the generative part of this. You know? I mean, I think Erickson's right about this, that there is something that continues to make you feel very alive and vibrant about this generative function in older age. And it can be very lonely to feel that, you know, that you can't do it. If you're lucky enough to have lots of grandchildren around, then, you know, that's great too. But if you don't, this is certainly another way.
Judy, what comes across, and it comes across certainly in both of our interviews and in other settings where we have worked together, and how you're generally received by people who know you, is that you are so open with your inner life, both what you know about it and your delight and surprise in learning new things about it. And that's really a gift that analysis has brought to you and that you bring to analysis. And it comes together in your passion. And that's my takeaway from these conversations we've had and the work you've done. You're passionate about it. The generativity really just bubbles up inside you. And you want to learn from others and receive from them and share with them and let us all gain more wisdom through yours and that which you gather from your colleagues. And I'm very grateful for it. I am certain that our listeners will feel as we do. It's a privilege to give you the space to share your thoughts and for us to receive them. So I want to thank you again. And with that is a standing invitation, Judy, for your next project. We're going to do this yet again.
Thank you, Harvey. It's been a pleasure to talk to you.
It really has. Thanks so much. Bye.
Bye.
Thank you for listening. If I may, I'd like to ask you to help us publicize our podcast by rating us on iTunes or simply sharing it with a friend. You can also visit our webpage, ipaoffthecouch.org. We can both subscribe and also add your comments. I'd also like to acknowledge the lovely rendition of Beethoven's Opus 18th String Quartet by the Allegri String Quartet on the Vivat label.